It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, new research just released today shows how one of our oldest ancestors might have died. We get the details from Gemma Tarlak of Discover Magazine.
First, a Capital Times investigation out today comes to some troubling conclusions about a veterans care facility in central Wisconsin. The investigation reveals complaints that elderly and over-medicated veterans suffering from a variety of physical and mental ailments are not receiving adequate care at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King in Waupaca County, and allegations of serious neglect are coming from both patients themselves as well as some employees at that facility.
In addition, the Veterans Home is bringing in surplus revenue, but state officials have increasingly transferred money away from the facility to subsidize other veterans' homes, as well as pay for other expenses and salaries in the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Caitlin Farrell joins us now. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times. Caitlin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, set the scene for us first, Caitlin. Tell us a little bit about this Wisconsin veterans' home at King.
Sure. So this is one of three veterans homes that is run by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. King is located in Waupaca County, and it kind of looks like a college campus. It spans like 321 acres. It sits on a lake, Rainbow Lake, up there. It's a pretty popular vacation destination, and it was founded just after the Civil War, originally to care for Civil War veterans and their spouses.
And who's there now?
So now there are veterans there. I think the biggest group of veterans they have are from the Vietnam War now, but there's still some World War II veterans there. And any veteran living in the state of Wisconsin and their spouse are eligible to live there. And the home also takes folks who live outside of the state, too.
Now, this facility, as I understand it, and the state has pointed toward this in your investigation, gets high ratings nationally. It has a reputation for being a place that has a lot of good services, good conditions there. What were the signs that people were having concerns about this?
Sure. Well, yes, you're right. The state has scored very well on one metric, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services rankings. And those rankings are a bit complicated. They involve several parts. There's a component that involves an on-site inspection, but there is another about two-thirds of what goes into an overall composite score that a facility gets is self-reported information that the agency gives, to the federal government, and that's not audited or checked. And so residents there and folk employees who are there as well had some concerns, specifically with staffing issues and the capacity to care for how priorities and spending are affecting that.
So you talked, as you mentioned, to staff there and residents. Also, you profiled family members and even volunteers who work there. What kind of picture started to emerge?
So I've been looking at this over the course of several months, and it sort of just really became a snowball effect of one person kind of led to the other person. And, without any kind of corroboration or anything, the stories were pretty remarkably consistent that there was a real sense that as the state sought to financially turn the homes around, people were concerned that their spending priorities were out of line, that persistent staffing shortages and turnover really led to problems in care, and there was concerns, from a variety of ends about that.
Can you talk about some of the individual stories you heard from family members and residents about concerns about the care they were receiving?
Right. So a common concern did go back to staffing. So often if a member were to put on a call light or a request a nurse, because there's so many members on the floor and not enough aides to really care for them, they felt like they waited a long time because there's so much turnover. There was a component people felt where staff lost that weren't knowledgeable as much about the particular member they were caring for. And so because of that, there was issues with medicine not being given to the correct person. Also some concerns about medical equipment being outdated or things, the facility not really being updated. And also cares, considerations too about how employees there were trained, that there's not an emphasis really on veteran specific care.
And that issue of equipment in the facility is one that seems to keep coming up. It's an older facility now, the buildings there, but also modern computer systems that we see in a lot of commercial or, you know, private medical facilities, not there, not up to date at this facility?
Well, and that depends on who you ask. Employees I've talked to have said that it is not, and I've spoken with folks who have been familiar with how money's allocated there. The state has maintained that they have kept up with what's, you know, needed to be improved. They have pointed to money that they've spent. Governor Walker authorized, you know, $80 million for a new facility. But the concern that kept coming up as I was talking to people was why it was always kind of a game of catch up. You know, why are we sort of wait until, you know, the new facility that's going to be built is replacing a building there that has been vacant for 20 years. So really more of a concern that we're reacting rather than being very innovative and proactive in how to care for a very specific kind of nursing home patient and a very specific kind of demographic.
We're talking to Caitlin Farrell from the Capital Times, talking about her investigation of the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King, that's in Waupaca County. Caitlin, bottom line, are people saying this is affecting the health, well-being, quality of life for the veterans at this facility?
Yes. Yes, and the residents themselves are saying that as well.
And a lot of times we might assume, okay, well, there's just not enough money to go around. This is a sad reality. We just don't have the budget for this sort of thing. But that's kind of part two of the story. This is a facility that's bringing in a lot of money, it sounds like, but a lot of that money is going elsewhere. Can you trace that out for us?
Sure. So, yes, the state is there's been a lot of excess surplus revenue from these homes. The agency really turned that around. The homes were running on deficits, you know, years before. And so, increasingly as the home has been filled to capacity and it's brought in more money, the state then has transferred that money to its Veterans Trust Fund, which has faced some deficits in the past and some funding issues as well. And the agency says that they use that trust fund to fund other really valuable benefits and programs for veterans in the state, but it also funds salaries as well. And so, for folks that have concerns about care there and have concerns about why certain things are prioritized as far as spending goes, you know, there's a real question about whether money should be moved away from the home at all. If the state is receiving federal money to care for veterans, I think the question was, shouldn't they be using all of that money to care for veterans? I recognize too, I did not speak with all 700, there's about 700 members of King. My story does not, claim to be, you know, wholly representative. I didn't speak to everyone there, but I did interview several dozen people, you know, across different times in different places. And again, a lot of their stories were pretty remarkably consistent. So.
And have state lawmakers been reacting and looking for more information on this?
They have. As soon as I started asking questions of a couple lawmakers, like Senator Luther Olson, most notably, he's a Republican and he represents the district in which that facility sits. He has now called for a legislative audit. Senator Julie Lassa has called before I took out the story. I mean, she's called years ago and voiced her concerns to the governor
about this particular facility.
And she's sort of been, she's the one lawmaker, to my understanding, has really kind of been on the front end of it. A lot of people have gone to her and called her with issues.
You heard from a lot of different voices, again, patients, staff, volunteers, family members. Is there any kind of consensus of the one thing we need here is fill in the blank?
Right. Overwhelmingly, the one thing that folks have told me that they really want and need is a true independent investigation into the home, into how it's spending the federal money that it receives. I think that in the past, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services also regulates the home and puts on, does inspections there. But there's a sense from many of the folks I talked to that they really want a non-state entity. They sort of see DHS, WDVA, all sort of within the same sphere of the Walker administration, the state, and feel like there's a conflict of interest there. So,
looking for a more separate, independent agency to manage this?
Well, at least a separate independent agency to review it and investigate it. Senator Luther Olson has suggested that maybe it might be worth looking at whether the home should be moved into another state agency, maybe into DHS, because right now, you know, the Department of Veterans Affairs runs it. But as far as what I've been told, many residents and employees and family members would like to see is a really non-state independent investigation or audit into the home.
So those are the next steps some people are looking for. What are your next steps as you follow this story?
So I have a couple follow-up stories that are going to be coming up about the home. And so looking more into issues of finance and the federal ratings and how that works. This metric that keeps coming up is the CMS 5-star ratings. And it's a pretty complex metric. It has a lot of different pieces, and some folks and researchers have taken issue with that. And so I'll be looking at that a bit more about the money and more about this agency. That should be in the Cap Times coming up in the next couple days.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Caitlin Farrell. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times. She joined us to talk about her investigation at the Capital Times, looking at allegations of neglect at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King in Waupaca County. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll talk to a guest who says America's police culture has a masculinity problem, which is adding to tensions between police officers and the communities that they serve.
Right now, big news broke this morning in the field of paleoanthropology. New research shows how Lucy, one of our distant ancestors, or a cousin of our ancestors maybe, died over 3 million years ago. Lucy's remains were found in Ethiopia in 1974, at the time the oldest hominin fossil ever found.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to talk about this and other paleopathology news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us about once a month to talk about cool science news. And Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So big news, anything to do with Lucy? Everyone's fascinated with this oldest human ancestor, and now we might have new clues about how she died. What do we know?
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, I read a lot of these journal articles, and always the fossil is referred to, you know, as HD21-4 or whatever. And this paper, it was so strange to be reading it. It came out in Nature this morning, and it was so strange because it was in some ways... It was so personal because throughout the paper, the researchers refer to her as Lucy. So they talk about, you know, Lucy had more than 20 fractures, unfortunately, suffered right before her death. And, you know, the only way Lucy, they keep calling her Lucy, and it personalized in a way that I'm really not used to seeing in the literature. But here's what we know. They were able to determine, using high-res CT scans of all the fossils that we have of Lucy, that she suffered really a catastrophic fall that resulted in a number of fractures, including tellingly compressive fractures, and those really only happen under certain circumstances. So because of the presence of those fractures and where they were found, they think they know she fell feet first from a tree, they think from a height of about 40 feet. She landed kind of on her heels, and like any of us do when we fall, she stuck her arms out to brace her fall, so she suffered additional fractures in the shoulder there, and you know, she landed, and by the time she was on the ground, she had just a cascade of catastrophic injuries, and they think she died very shortly after.
Well, that raises a lot of questions, and one that pops to mind is, why do they think tree in particular as opposed to, I don't know, cliff or something like that?
I asked this very question when I was talking to some folks familiar with the research. And basically, we, you know, the area where Lucy was found, it's called the Afar region of Ethiopia. And in addition to Lucy, we found a number of other hominin fossils there. Lucy is by far the most famous and the most complete and, you know, 3.18 million years old, so she's no spring chicken. But they know so much about that area. It's been so well covered by paleoanthropological digs. They've been able to pretty much recreate the environment she lived in, and it was woodland. It was kind of like lakeshore, so there was nothing to be a cliff nearby. You know, it was pretty flat land.
So apparently this is stirring up a bit of debate about Lucy and whether she and others, I guess, like her at the time, walked on 2 feet or whether they lived in trees.
Yeah, well, the debate is actually, do they spend most of their time in trees, or were they really terrestrial, fully upright, walking, bipedal individuals? And, you know, the reason Lucy, in particular, it presents, and all members of her species presents such a question mark, is because they have what researchers call a mosaic of traits, in that she and other members of her species have some features that you see in tree-climbing individuals, such as, you know, really long fingers that can grab a branch really securely. There's certain musculature in the shoulders. But at the same time, other features like her pelvis and the shape of her leg bones, that suggests she was walking bipedal. So, you know, some researchers say, hey, she spent some time in the trees, some time on the ground, let's just get over it. But for decades, ever since she's been found, there are folks who think, no, she was only upright walking on the ground, and other folks who say, no, she was arboreal living in the trees. So, to me, this finding kind of suggests that the folks who see her as a little bit of both are right. Because, you know, if you're a super-duper tree climber, if you live your whole life in the trees, there's less chance of you falling out. But, you know, think of us. We're fully upright. We're fully bipedal. We still climb trees now and then, you know, to pick fruit or to just have fun, whatever. And we still fall out of those trees sometimes, too.
And remind us, Gemma, of Lucy's place in our complicated and ever more complicated family tree.
How much time?
Sorry, and not a tree we would fall out of, hopefully.
Right. Well, I was going to say, how much time do you have? Because that is another point of contention. For a long time, we thought, oh, Lucy is definitely our direct ancestor. She's our great, 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 great to the nth times grandmother. But no, because, you know, there's so many fossils being found that have been found since her, especially in South Africa. So now there's two different camps that say, East Africa, where Lucy was found, that's definitely where we originated. Another camp says, hey, wait a minute, we've got great fossils from that same time or earlier of other species. Maybe South Africa is our homeland.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she's joining us now to talk about new research published just today showing how Lucy, that famous distant ancestor, died, and we're going to talk about some dinosaur stuff too now, Gemma. In particular, dinosaurs apparently get tumors. This is big news in the dino world. What do we know about these tumors?
Yeah, you know, and this is fascinating because it's just really in the last month or so that we have two big studies coming out using basically XMT, that's X-ray microtomography. If you want to think about it in the simplest of terms, it's kind of like CT scanning on a super, super fine scale. And by employing this recent technology, they are able to look at fossils and really see what is going on a cellular level. And for example, about a month and a half ago, they found a duck-billed dinosaur with osteosarcoma in its jaw. First time they've ever found that in a dinosaur. It's a benign tumor, so, you know, we don't think it died from that or anything. It may have impeded chewing, but it's basically, it's called an ameloblastic tumor, and, you know, it just forms, and it's found in mammals today. So it's what we thought of as a modern type of tumor, but it was found in dinosaurs, you know, 70 million years ago. And then there was another study out that, not about a tumor, but about septic arthritis, and that is a really super nasty infection of the joint, and it eventually erodes away the bones. It is horrible. And today, birds and reptiles and humans can get septic arthritis, but they found it in another duck-billed dinosaur that's, again, you know, more than 70 million years old. So all this XMT technology, the X-ray microtomography, is really allowing researchers to look at bones in a way they could never look at before. And the best thing is, it's non-invasive. So if you don't destroy the fossil by slicing it up to look at it, it's all digital, so you can go back again and again to that sample.
So we're starting to get a picture of not just what dinosaurs looked like and ate and things like that. At least in some cases, we're able to find evidence of what kind of diseases they were plagued by.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen in the past, there's a very famous dinosaur in Wyoming. It's an allosaur on display, and that poor dinosaur, man, he went to the grave in a lot of pain because he had all kinds of bone breaks and fractures that they think were caused either fighting another dinosaur or maybe, you know, a hunting expedition that didn't go so well. So he has all these kind of acute injuries, but now we're able to see on this much finer microtomography scale actual bone growths and malformations that you see with things like cancer and septic arthritis and other diseases that before we really couldn't see with the naked eye.
So what other kinds of things might we be able to find out now that we're learning about these various dinosaur ailments and pathologies? What's next?
Well, you know, last year, a very similar technology was employed to actually look into the fossil and find remnants of dinosaur blood cells. and other kind of soft tissue remnants that we would never expect to find in fossils. And the interesting thing about that last year was that they were not using great fossils. They were using kind of the crummy fossils that paleontologists keep in the drawer because they're too crummy to display. So really, now we can just go through the fossil catalog, all those bones and bits of bones that have been sitting in drawers in museums and academies all over the world. We can go through them with this new technology and find all kinds of stuff that we never even thought to look for.
Gemma, all this technology, whether we're talking about figuring out what kind of cancer dinosaurs had or how Lucy died, is there overlap here? Are these things coming out of the world of medical research and, crime and forensics?
Well, I don't know about crime and forensics, but I know, for example, with the Lucy story, after they identified all these very specific fractures, they did compare her fractures and her scans with those from actual clinical patients who were presenting with, a compressive fracture or whatever. And the paleoanthropologists at the University of Texas, Austin, worked with clinicians, doctors who were in the ER practice and orthopeds and everything, orthopods rather. They looked at those injuries that you see in today's ERs, and that's how they built their case for what happened to Lucy.
And Gemma, let's wrap up by going back to Lucy, because this was big news in a lot of ways. Now that we figured out how she died and there is still this debate about how tree-dwelling Lucy was, what are the other big questions about Lucy that might break, that have the possibility to break in the coming years?
Wow, that is, we found about 40% of her skeleton. So we've got a lot of it, more than other hominins, but still, there are a lot of questions. And I think the big break is really going to be not with Lucy, but what else we find from that era of our family tree. And I hope one day we're going to find the fossil that tells us definitively whether we should call Lucy granny or auntie.
Hmm. Well, Gemma, we've argued about this before, but I'm still saying time machine. We need a time machine and we go back and look. You like the mystery more.
I do, because, if you think about what we knew about, say, dinosaurs or Lucy 10, 20 years ago, and think, just, it's thrilling how much we've learned since then, and a time machine would just be cheating. Come on.
Right.
Spoken like a scientist at heart.
Well, Gemma, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this new science news.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins to talk about new research published today showing how Lucy, our famous distant ancestor or, close cousin back in there somewhere, how she passed away.
Coming up after the news, does America's police culture have a problem with masculinity? A law and policing expert weighs in on that question. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on gun background checks in Wisconsin.
First, criticism of police in America seems to have reached a critical mass in recent months following the deaths of several African-American men at the hands of police, including Philandro Castile of Falcon Heights, Minnesota, and Alton Sterling of Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Our next guest says that while the recent controversies over policing have often been pinned on racial bias, there may be more at play, including the idea of gender and masculinity, and that a hyper-masculine police culture may be a part of police community tensions.
Frank Rudy Cooper joins us now. He's a professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston, Massachusetts, where he studies criminal procedure, cultural studies, and masculinity studies, especially as it applies to policing of men of color. Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as we mentioned in the pieces you've written lately, you say race is a factor in these tensions, but we may be overlooking gender and how it plays into it. Why is that?
Well, I think police officers have long had a tendency to racial profile, and that's been documented in New York City and many other places. But I think that tendency to racial profile is aggravated by a simultaneous tendency towards machismo. And I could give an example of what I mean by machismo or masculinity when it comes to sort of criminal law.
Yeah, go ahead and talk through that example.
Sure. So I'm getting ready to teach criminal law tomorrow morning. So on my mind is the fact that the reasonable man acts in a heat of passion when he sees his wife in adultery. And that's a doctrine in the criminal law that applies or traditionally has applied more to men than to women. And that just speaks to our expectations of men are sometimes a little different than our expectations of women. I certainly wouldn't argue that masculinity is nature, but scholars such as Carol Gilligan have pointed out that in general, men have more of a tendency to act in an aggressive and hierarchical way, and in general, women have more of a tendency to act in a compromise-oriented fashion. So I've just looked at that possibility that masculinity is leading police officers, certainly male police officers, sometimes maybe female police officers, to act in an aggressive way when they're confronted with suspects.
Right, and as you say, that isn't necessarily natural that masculinity behaves in that way, but do you see it as a cultural way of behaving for men in particular? Do you see that as being even more so in police culture than in culture at large?
Absolutely, I think it's cultural. And in police culture, we know that we pull police officers from parts of our culture that are more masculine or certainly more aggressive than other parts of our culture, like the military. So almost every police department gives a significant advantage to veterans of the military. That's great in certain ways, right? We do want to prioritize people who have served our country, but that's a culture that is more aggressive, and if that's brought into the police culture, you're going to see a police culture that's more aggressive than the rest of our culture is.
Well, somebody might make the case that, well, maybe there's an upside to that. Police are, in many cases, dealing with criminals, maybe dealing with violent behavior, maybe coming in with that tough guy mindset in a way prepares them to deal with that more than other people maybe in civilian America.
That may be the case, and I certainly acknowledge that there are times when I want police officers to be aggressive. So there's a concept in policing called command presence. And command presence just means taking charge of a situation. But you can take charge of a situation with your voice, or you can take charge of a situation with your fists or your baton or your taser or your gun. And my concern is that police officers who have more of a tendency towards a sort of macho attitude may be more likely to respond with violence earlier than they need to.
Talking to Frank Rudy Cooper, he's a law professor looking at what he sees as often a problem of masculinity, a macho culture in police culture. Frank, walk us through how this might work out in a bad way, in an encounter between an officer and a suspect, especially maybe a black young male suspect, or
right,
not even a suspect, I guess, a civilian.
Yeah, so if you think of a civilian who's out there like Philando Castile, and they're stopped by the police for, say, a traffic violation, there's potential for macho posturing on both sides. You've got somebody as a young black male who may have been stopped many times by the police, and because of our history of racial profiling, may not believe that they've been appropriately stopped, or at least that they haven't been stopped at a time when other people would have been stopped. So, you know, if you're a man and you are feeling, man or woman really, but if you're feeling that this is a sign of disrespect and you draw on our cultural sort of assumption that a man responds aggressively to disrespect, then you may have a civilian who is ready for a conflict. And then you can take the Sandra Bland case, where the police officer, you know, was ready to light her up with his taser because she wouldn't put out her cigarette when he was talking to her. Now, that's disrespectful, no question of that. But does it require the immediate move to violence and to an arrest? I don't think that it does. I think both of those are situations where you can see from the civilian side or the police officer side that it might be that a sense that you have to be shown respect is something that could exacerbate a potential conflict.
So a hyper-masculine idea that any disrespect has to be treated as a challenge, I guess, and escalated. Is that what you're seeing working out here?
Absolutely. So the idea behind hyper-masculinity, just a really strong version of masculinity, would be that you can't brook any disrespect. And then in police culture, there is some good reason for feeling that you have to maintain control of situations, and that leads some police officers to have a quick trigger for wanting to shut down disrespect.
You're hoping for a different kind of training for police officers to still, as you said, take command of a situation when needed, but not by escalating that situation. What would that kind of training look like?
So there are a variety of options out there. One that I've mentioned in a past article is called verbal judo. And I don't necessarily want to endorse this particular method, but I think something like this might be helpful. Verbal judo is that you train the police officer to sort of spar with the suspect verbally. So the suspect is some young kid who's in front of his or her friends and wants to mouth off to the cop. The cop could sort of jaw back at the civilian, but in a way that takes the situation down. Look, I know you're in front of your friends. You know, you don't want to be shown, disrespect by a police officer. That's fine. Here's how we can clear up this situation. Here's how I can get the information that I need without my having to respond to my baton or something else to deal with you. So verbal judo is more a matter of sort of getting the upper hand on somebody verbally. But what I imagine is something more along the lines of, we don't have to be in a conflict here, right? All I need is this information from you. You know, where's your license, or what are you doing in this area? There's been a call about you. I just want to clear it up. And I refer to that as a de-escalation.
A lot of people, and I've seen this in comments, logs, and editorials, things like that, will look at a situation where an encounter between a police officer and a citizen escalates. There's disrespect shown on both sides. It keeps building on each other, and people saying both sides are more or less equally to blame. And you don't buy that.
No, I don't. Police officers, they are sworn to serve and protect. They are given the power to kill people, and they need to be more responsible than the typical civilian. I expect them to have a higher threshold for their temper. I expect them to be better behaved than I am. That's what they're paid for. As a law professor, I get paid to be clear in explaining certain concepts in the law. They get paid to manage conflict, and most of them, I should say, are much better certainly than I am at managing conflict. But when they're not, when they're just like any other hot-headed young civilian, I blame the person who's been given a gun and the responsibility of managing conflict more than I blame the hot-headed kid.
Do you think if training is changed, if police go more and more toward de-escalation rather than the use of force to control situations, do you think that benefits ultimately the police themselves?
I think it absolutely could. One of the things that came out about racial profiling was that the police were often harming themselves by being seen as picking on racial minorities. So then they went back into the racial minority community to get information about a crime that happened there or elsewhere, and there was a stop snitching sort of attitude. And perhaps the racial profiling led people to feel, you just don't talk to the police, period. So that's one problem. Another thing, I think, is that if the police are seen as not looking for conflict, they're likely to just deal with less potential conflict. Civilians are more likely, if they see police officers as peace brokers, to take their own sort of more peaceful attitude towards the police, not to be on edge and fearful every time they encounter the police. And certainly police officers want more peaceful citizens.
We're talking to Frank Rudy Cooper. He's a professor of law at Suffolk University. He recently wrote a piece called America's Police Culture Has a Masculinity Problem.
And we want to know what you think. Would you agree with our guest's assessment that so-called masculine behavior might be driving some of the current pressure points between police officers and communities of color? And if so, how do you think these behaviors should be addressed? Or do you disagree with this assessment? Why do you think that is? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a moment here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking with law professor Frank Rudy Cooper. In a recent piece, he says America's police culture has a masculinity problem and that a hyper-masculine police culture may be contributing to current tensions between police and communities of color.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think these kind of macho attitudes are partly to blame for police violence in America, for tough relationships between police and the communities they serve? Call in now. 800-642-1234. What's the solution? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Ben with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I've had the opportunity over the years to participate in some police weapons and tactics training sessions, and I think the professor view in many cases is accurate. I just wanted, the comment I wanted to make was that I think that part of the problem is that the police really are, and I'm sure the professor will agree with this, that the police are representatives of the court. And many citizens feel under the Constitution that they should be afforded all the protections under the Constitution when dealing with the justice system. But many police see themselves not as representatives of the court, but rather as an embodiment of the law itself. So people have to obey them because they are the law.
Interesting, Ben. Thanks for the call. Frank, what do you think?
Well, I absolutely agree that police officers ought to think of themselves as having a responsibility not to impose something like contempt of cop. So a lot of people are familiar with the fact that there's contempt of court, and that's because a court has the inherent power to punish you for disobeying the court in the courtroom. But police officers don't have that power, and sometimes they try and exercise a power to say, you can't disrespect me, you can't obstruct me, and that's not right as a matter of the law. Police officers represent the executive branch, and so they're a little bit different than representing the court, but I agree with the sentiment that Ben expressed.
Thanks for the call, Ben. We'll go next to Seth in Oshkosh. Seth, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my, I guess, view on it is, you know, we're hiring these young cops at 23, 24, and sometimes even younger, and myself and a lot of friends, most males, remember when you were at that age, you knew everything, you had a temper, and you were a hothead. And I think we could solve a lot of the problems if they would hire cops maybe in their 30s to have, you know, dealt with people, dealt with real situations. I mean, I know kids come right out of high school, they go to the academy, and they're becoming cops, and they've never had a drink themselves, never dealt with a drunk person, never dealt with a person on drugs and whatnot. I know they're trained to deal with these people, but until you get some real life training on your belt, it's, you know, they're going to be hotheads. And then you give them a badge and a gun and the power that, you know, they are the judge and the jury, and it's just going to lead to problems until we change, I believe, the age at which you hire young cops.
Seth, thanks for the call. So maybe not just race and gender, he's saying, but age, young men, masculinity, Frank, being part of the problem. What do you think?
Well, I absolutely agree with Seth, and I think of the old joke, teenagers move out of the house while you still know everything. And I certainly think that in my 20s, I had a similar experience of I thought I knew a lot more than I knew. The solution, it seems to me, is in our hiring processes. So I mentioned training earlier as one way to get police officers to de-escalate. And another way is to hire people who already come in with a sort of negotiation mentality rather than an aggressive and violence-oriented mentality.
Is there something to be said? Does it make a difference if there are more women on police forces?
It has. The research suggests that it does make a difference, at least in terms of police violence and claims of misconduct. Now, why is that so? Who knows? Is it nature? Is it nurture? I tend to think that it's nurture. And, of course, this doesn't apply to all women. It doesn't mean that just because you're dealing with a female cop that you're going to get a peaceful cop, and it doesn't mean that because you're dealing with a male cop you're going to get a particularly aggressive cop.
Talking to Frank Rudy Cooper. He's a law professor looking at issues of masculinity in police departments. Wanted to bring race back directly into this, Frank. Is there something about hyper-masculinity, an officer is going to read disrespect more so in the hands into the actions of a certain community, say young men of color?
Yes, I'm afraid so. We know about the racial tensions that have existed in this country from slavery to Jim Crow to contemporary forms of more implicit bias. And that's been focused among the police on young men of color, particularly blacks and Latinos. So I think that there is a lower threshold for feeling threatened by these young men of color. And that's unfortunate. It's something that's getting a lot better, but it's something we have to work on.
Let's bring back our callers now. We've got Gene on the line in Ashland. Gene, hi.
Hi. How about measuring anger point, like boiling point, for everyone? Seems like this can vary among different groups, but in their culture, they're trained to, if they just... assume or detect what they think is disrespect, they can hardly think after that.
Thanks for the call, Gene. So something about dealing with anger in particular, Frank, and maybe assessment of officers and how they handle anger and things that make them angry.
Yes, well, Gene's point again goes to the question of hiring. So we might want to have some additional evaluative methods for figuring out when people are likely to get angry and how they manage their anger. Certainly there are protocols in certain police departments where if you're involved in a conflict, they try and rotate that police officer away from the scene and let others manage that situation. And that seems like best practices. If there's been some kind of shouting match between a police officer and a civilian, and then other officers are coming on the scene, let the officers who can take a fresh eye at the situation deal with the situation.
So what would you like to see happen next? How do we start to change this, what you see as a culture of hyper-masculinity in many police departments?
I think changes in hiring. I think changes in training would be very important. And part of that is that we spend a lot of time training police officers how to handle their weapons, which is important, and very little time teaching them about implicit bias. Certainly in Boston now, Commissioner Evans has been a leader in adding implicit bias training to the training of police officers, and I think that's very important. I'd just like to see more people emphasize the acknowledgement of tensions between police officers in certain communities, and then the training with how to manage those tensions without resorting to violence.
You've been studying and researching this for some time, Frank. Have you gotten any feedback from police officers, from police departments? Do they want to hear what you're saying? Do they want to tackle these problems?
Yeah, so I haven't gotten a lot of direct feedback from them, although I had Commissioner Evans in my criminal procedure class, and as a general matter, I think he thinks it's important to change the way that police officers are trained. At a more general level, there is increasing training on implicit bias across the country, and I'm really glad to see that. So I think that there are some changes coming. We'll have to see how far they go. In Boston recently, Boston has been one of the more progressive police departments because of Commissioner Evans, but recently the police officers sued to try and prevent the use of body cameras. I have to say that honestly, I'm not the biggest fan of body cameras, but suing to prevent them seems counter to thinking of yourself as a subject to civilian review rather than immune from it.
And very briefly, as we wrap up, Frank, I mean, with the issues of race, some people have said you can't just treat the police departments. They're us. They're the society that they live in. Do you think the same is true when it comes to masculinity?
I do think that that's right, that you have to treat in some ways the society, and there is more acknowledgement of the problems of masculinity bubbling up in the schools, and hopefully that trickles down to police departments.
Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Frank Rudy Cooper. He's a professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston, Massachusetts, where he studies criminal procedure, cultural studies, and masculinity studies, especially as it applies to policing of men of color. He joined us to talk about a recent piece he wrote, and we'll have that up at the Central Time Facebook page. In that piece, he looks at America's police culture and masculinity. Again, check out that piece and share your thoughts on that issue. You can do that at the Central Time Facebook page. And of course, as with any topic, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Six astronauts just returned after a year on Mars this weekend. You could hear the air quotes lingering there.
That's right. In this case, the side of a Hawaiian volcano stood in as Mars, and the six astronauts lived in close quarters in a small, isolated habitat on the side of that volcano. The idea here was to troubleshoot the kind of problems that might affect a small research team living in close quarters on another planet.
And here's what the participants said. They said one of the biggest problems was boredom. Participants said future astronauts should bring something to keep them busy in the downtime between experiments and emergencies.
And when they returned from Mars, air quotes, they had a quick chance to get some of their favorite Earth foods that they had missed before they had to go and meet the press. One of them loaded up on as many raspberries as she could get her hands on. I guess no raspberries in your Mars ration kits. What would you miss being isolated like that? But isolated in a group with, you know, with six people in the room.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like the hardest thing,
right?
First of all, for someone who recharges by being alone, being with six people. And I think this was a 1,200-foot, as they call it, habitat. Mm-hmm. That sounds tough enough. But shortly after that on the list, I'm going to have to say watermelon and Wisconsin's amazing cheese.
Yeah, I don't think Mars cheese is probably going to be all that good. If there's any freeze-dried cheese, doesn't sound great. Yeah, so lock me in a quiet room with lots and lots of extra sharp cheddar when I come home from Mars.
Excellent. I'm right there. But wait, we don't want to be in the same room.
Right.
That's not going to work.
Two different rooms. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.